we can read from Srimad Bhagavatam on a topic that is of vital importance to everyone. The effect of associating with devotees, and maybe we can say the active ingredient of associating with devotees. It's a big topic. It's one of the most essential topics in Krishna consciousness, sadhu sangha. We just had our sadhu sangha festival, so that's very, very important. I'm going to depart a little bit from tradition, aside from using a computer instead of a talpatra. And I'm going to also step a little bit outside of our direct line of disciplic succession by reading a poem that was written in the 17th century by a Brajbhasha poet named Priyadas, who was actually in the disciplic succession coming from Srinivas Acharya. So not so far out of our line. But he wrote a commentary on a famous Brajbhasha book called Bhaktimal. And that commentary is called Bhakti Rasa Bodhani. In it he has one poem among many, and this poem is titled Satsanga Prabhava Varna, the effect of associating with devotees. So he says, Bhakti Taru Paurhatahi Vikna Dara Cheri Huko Bari De Vichara Bari Sincho Satsanga Song Lagyoi Badhana Goda Chahun Dishi Karhan So Sant Ura Al Bala Shobhita Vishala Chaya Jive Jivat Jalatapa Gaijon Prasangasong Dekho Bharavadi Jahi Ajahunki Shankahuti Tahi Peda Banthe Julain Hathi Jite Jangasong. Which means the tree of faith, the tree of faith, was but a sapling so fragile that it might be stunted by a single kid. Everybody know what a kid is? We don't have kids in America. A kid is actually, in this context, a baby goat. Incorrect. So, in India, I remember where I was living in Vrindavan, we looked out our window and the neighbor had planted a nice garden there, but did not fence it in. And every day around 12 or so, they would bring the goats. And they wiped it out in one sitting, his whole garden. So the tree of faith was but a sapling that might be stunted by a single kid. It was given the fence of discrimination and sprinkled with the water of consort with the holy. That means satsanga. It began to wax great, and branches and twigs did it put forth on every side. It climbed to the sky, and its glory spread manifold over the earth. For the basin from which its roots drew moisture was the bosom of the holy. Again, satsanga. Glorious and widespread was its shade. All things that live found cool and drew fresh life beneath it. Mark well its growth. Once it was a feeble thing for whose sake we feared a goat, and now, shackled to that wondrous tree, contentedly sway mighty elephants. Like a banyan tree, when it grows big, you can tie an elephant to a banyan tree, a big banyan tree, and that elephant is not going anywhere. That's the strength of satsanga, association with the devotees. Now, I'm going to switch back into Sanskrit world and read from the Srimad Bhagavatam. So let us begin with Mangala Charana.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Narayanam namaskritya.
Narayanam namaskritya.
Naram chaiva narottamam.
Naram chaiva narottamam.
Devim Saraswatim Vyasam.
Devim Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam
Ujjayam Udhiraye
Nashta
Praishu Abhadreshu
Nashta Praishu Abhadreshu
Nityam Bhagavat Sevaya
Nityam Bhagavat Sevaya
Bhagavati Uttama Shloke
Bhagavati Uttama Shloke
Bhaktir Bhavati Naishthiki
Bhaktir Bhavati Naishthiki
Krishne Swadhamo Pagate
Krishne Swadhamo Pagate
Dhanam Agnanadithisah Kalau nashtra drishamesha
Kalau nashtra drishamesha
Puranarko dhunoditaham
Puranarko
Used to be everybody knew this verse, Kali Yuga. It means that now that the sun, now that Krishna has departed, this is spoken 5,000 years ago, along with dharma and jnana and everything else that we require to make spiritual advancement, or everything at least that makes spiritual advancement easier, we should say. This Srimad Bhagavatam has appeared, and it's just as brilliant as the sun. And even though this age of Kali is dense darkness, people who are hearing Srimad Bhagavatam from the right source, they will get light, as if the sun were shining in the sky. So in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in chapter 5, text 24, we hear from Narad Muni the story of how he became Krishna conscious. Just for those who don't know, Narad Muni was brought up by a maidservant, and the maidservant, it would appear, was not even sure who his father was. And eventually his mother was bitten by a snake. And she departed from this world when Narad was only 5. Narad took it, he was somehow fortunate enough that he took it as the hand of God, that unfortunate turn of events. How many 5-year-olds can do this? Not very many. So he began to wander, and he saw so many places, and eventually he came to a solitary place where he decided to meditate on the Supreme Personality of God, and he eventually saw the Lord. This is described. Now, in his youth, his mother was working at an inn. And during the rainy season, sometimes Chaturmasya, the sages, they're called Bhaktivedantas, as a matter of fact, yogis, dvijas, they would sometimes come and stay there. And for 4 months, he had the opportunity to render service to these sages and to hear from them about Krishna consciousness. And so he was benefited just by this association. He also describes, I'll continue reading right now. This text 24 says, Te mai apetakhila chapaler bhake dante adhrita kridana ke nuvartini chakru kripam yadyapi tulya darshanaha sushrushamane muni olpa bhashini. Translation. Though the sages saw everything equally, they showed mercy to me, by which I, though a boy, developed sense control, gave up child's play and all agitation, became obedient, served attentively, and spoke little. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has written a nice commentary on these verses. Let us first see what Srila Prabhupada has to say, because this is what we really want. We want to hear from the Bhaktivedantas. And here Srila Prabhupada explains in his purport. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says, all the Vedas are searching after me. Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya says that in the Vedas, the subject matters are only 3, namely to establish the relation of the living entities with the personality of Godhead, perform the relative duties in devotional service, and thus achieve the ultimate goals back to Godhead. As such, the Vedantavadis, or the followers of the Vedanta, indicate the pure devotees of the personality of Godhead. such Vedantavadis or the Bhaktivedantas are impartial in distributing the transcendental knowledge of devotional service. To them, no one is enemy or friend, no one is educated or uneducated, no one is especially favorable, and no one is unfavorable. The Bhaktivedantas see that the people in general are wasting time in false, sensuous things. Their business is to get the ignorant mass of people to reestablish their lost relationship with the personality of Godhead. By such endeavor, even the most forgotten soul is roused up to the sense of spiritual life, and thus being initiated by the Bhaktivedantas, the people in general gradually progress on the path of transcendental realization. So, the Vedantavadis initiated the boy even before he became self-controlled and was detached from childish sporting, etc. But before the initiation, the boy became more and more advanced in discipline, which is very essential for one who wishes to make progress in the line. This is a very famous line. I'll jump ahead here. Without being self-controlled, without being disciplined, and without being fully obedient, no one can become successful in following the instructions of the spiritual master. And without doing so, no one is able to go back to Godhead. I mentioned a moment ago that he had certain qualifications, or along with Lord Krishna, certain qualifications disappeared from this earth with the onset of the Kali Yuga. Those qualifications are dharma and jnana. And they're actually not essential for pure devotional service, but they're extremely helpful. So much so that Srila Prabhupada indicates that here, because he's talking about some of the symptoms of these two things. Without being self-controlled, without being disciplined, and without being fully obedient, no one can become successful in following the instructions of the spiritual master. In case you haven't noticed yet, following the instructions of the spiritual master is an essential item of Krishna consciousness. We'll talk about that in a moment. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, has said some interesting things as well. He says that the Narad Muni is amazed that they showed mercy to him. Although great devotees such as Bharat and Prahlad see equally, they also show some partiality concerning giving mercy. Their first show of mercy did not depend on Narada's good qualities and show of respect. He's talking about the Bhaktivedantas here. He developed the good qualities by their mercy. Then those qualities became the cause of further mercy. If we require continual mercy to advance in spiritual life, then these things are very helpful for us. So, Narad Muni did not have these qualifications when he first encountered these Bhaktivedantas. The qualifications came because he encountered the Bhaktivedantas. And then when the qualities were there, they were reinvested. In devotional service, we get so many fringe benefits. They have to be reinvested in the process, because the temptation is always there to cash out and take the money and run. The money meaning the karma or the gyan, the dharma or the gyan, as we might say. So, therefore, we mentioned last night, sometimes bhakti itself, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, is considered to be the cause of anarthas, ironically enough. Anartha meaning the things that obstruct our spiritual advancement. That's a big topic, but we should not divert too much. So, he developed good qualities by their mercy. Then those qualities became the cause of further mercy. It must be explained that the cause of their mercy was not due to seeing qualities in Narad. It was causeless, in other words. If one says that although they had equal vision, they showed mercy because he showed some qualities, then their equal vision would be contradicted by their seeing good and bad qualities and considering those things. So one should not explain in this way, because then the first mercy would be prejudiced. And mercy by nature is causeless. I think the word he's using here in his commentary is, I'll find it here, tesham nirupadhi karunatvam. They had, you know, nirupadhi karuna, you can say, means a kind of mercy that you can't classify. There's no upadhi there. And he further calls it, I will read on. Now, this gets really interesting. He says, there are two types of mercy. Kripa hi dvividha gunamai nirgunacha. That means there are two kinds of mercy. One is qualified, or that is to say, affected by seeing material qualities, and the other one is not affected by seeing material qualities. It's gunamai mercy and nirguna mercy. The first type of mercy is explained as follows. All persons in the material world have mercy caused by qualities. When someone is nice to us, we feel, yes, I should do a favor for him, isn't it? It's motivated. There's a hetu. There's a reason for it. There's a cause, in other words. Hetu also means cause. It's a great word. It means both your motive and the cause. Because in this material world, that's all we have to work with. Everyone has a motive here. So that's the first kind of mercy. When we see qualities in a person, we feel mercy, or we feel merciful. And if we don't see those qualities, then the qualities are absent, and we withdraw the mercy. That's the kind of business. And if we see bad qualities, that is to say flaws, then what do? We feel some hatred. We become attracted and repulsed. We become, you know, we're judgmental, in a word. So those who see beyond the influence of the material world always show mercy without such causes, because without dependence on seeing material qualities, since they see everything in the material world as the same. Srila Prabhupada was like that. It happened that a disciple did so many nonsense things, so many. All the devotees they didn't like him around. They just wanted to get rid of him because he was such a nuisance. And Prabhupada didn't think like that. He still gave mercy to that person. So he quotes Shukdev Goswami, Girayo mumuchus toyam kvachinna mumuchus shivam yatha jnanamritam kale jnanino dadate nava. That's from the 10th canto, describing the autumn season. And in the autumn season, this is after the rainy season. Well, you know what happens in the rainy season. Everything is muddy and brown and bubbles everywhere in the rivers, correct? Everything becomes sullied, as it were. In the autumn, all that settles and the water becomes clear. But he says that during this season, the mountains sometimes release pure water and sometimes do not. Just as experts in transcendental science sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. That's from the 10th canto, 20th chapter, text 36. And in this manner, actually, Prabhupada gives a nice purport there, which I'll read. The first part of this chapter has described the rainy season, and the second part has been dealing with the autumn season, which begins when the rain stops. Yeah, I mean, basically he just summarizes what I've just said. But in this manner, sometimes these persons show mercy to someone when hardness of the heart is caused by the gunas is destroyed and the heart becomes soft by devotion to the Lord, then mercy will appear in the heart. We don't really know what mercy is yet, because we don't know what love yet is yet, because we have too many hetus that are impelling this. I had an educational experience when my tabla teacher, who happens to be an American, he wrote an article on arranged marriages of all topics. Arranged marriages. His marriage was arranged. He married a girl from Andhra Pradesh. Anyway, he said that arranged marriages work and are actually very good because they're based on something higher than just so-called love in the mature world, which means haituki love. You love your spouse only because this person is your spouse and for no other reason. Therefore, you can marry that person without even knowing them, if the parents have done their homework. You should not do the homework. You can't. There are prerequisites for that class. And one of the prerequisites is that you know there can't be any chemistry moving. So the parents and the gurujanas, they do the homework. They check out with the jyotish and they do everything and very carefully. I always advise people, see 3 jyotishas before you get married. Because one will say yes, one will say no, and then you need a tiebreaker. But he said that the only reason to love your spouse is because that person is your spouse. There's no hetu there. It immediately elevates through dharma. That so-called love, it's not really love yet either. It's only dharma at this point. But it elevates it to the platform in which you're a little bit transcendental to what's happening at the sensual level or at the mental and emotional and psychological levels. So in that sense, it's superior. And therefore it lasts. As long as there's no hetu, it will last. As soon as you introduce a hetu, if there's a reason that you love someone, then finished. Because that thing will be destroyed. It will be destroyed. Zarur. There's no doubt about it. This is how it works. Antavattu phalam teshan tadbhavati alvametasam. Those who are less intelligent, Krishna says, they take pleasure in things that are antavat. Antavat happiness. Antavat means possessing an end. And what doesn't end in this material world? Even the body will end. And sometimes the mind ends before the body ends. That's called dementia. I saw my mother go through it for 6 years. And most of us, at least many of us, will probably have to go there as well. You need to think about this. Jabalagatana me tapana vyape tabalaga kari hari seva. Ek bhakti kalin kavine kaha. So, in this manner, sometimes these persons show mercy to someone. But when the hardness of our hearts caused by association with the gunas is destroyed and has become soft through devotion, through bhakti to the Lord and through the devotees, then we can understand what is real mercy. Any quotes from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu? Ruchibhish chitta masranya krit asau bhava uchyate. This is the definition of bhav. Shuddha sattva visheshatma prema suryamshu samya bhak. That part of bhakti is called bhava, whose essence is knowledge, the knowledge and the ecstasy potencies of the Lord, which is only one ray of the sun that is prema. Prema means transcendental love of Godhead, perfect love of Godhead. And one kirana of that sun, which is compared to prema, that's called bhava. When we get some inkling in our hearts, when there's some light, which we mentioned already, from this Bhagavatam in this way, then our heart will soften. It's just like if you put, you know, some ghee in the sun in the winter time. It will melt because of the sun's rays. So the heart will melt like that, and it should be so. When our hearts are softened with a desire to meet, serve, and exchange love with the Lord, that's called bhava. So, there are 4 stages of bhakti to be understood here. Mercy of the devotees, causeless mercy. Then, service to the devotees. Then, faith. Then, taking shelter of the bona fide spiritual master. This is the understanding of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. It's an interesting point, isn't it? Mercy is so, unconditioned. So we can do nothing to generate that mercy. The mercy has to come first. But having received some mercy, then we can respond. If we are pious, we will respond to the mercy favorably, and that response can itself then generate a conditioned response, as the psychologists might call it. That is to say, we can demonstrate or develop some of the qualities that Narad Muni also demonstrated, and then when the spiritual master or the devotees are pleased with us, then we get more mercy, and we can reinvest that and continue to advance in this way. But the initial mercy is completely unconditional and causeless. Therefore, someone asked, a disciple asked Prabhupada, one of his American disciples said, you know, we don't have any qualities, we don't have any knowledge, we don't have anything. It's something like Sanatana Goswami said. He said, I don't have any prema, I don't have any attachment to the process of developing prema, that is to say sadhana bhakti. I don't have any knowledge, I've never done any punya, I've not practiced yoga very well. I don't even come from a nice family. So what am I going to do? I find that I'm completely bereft of any means by which I might approach the Lord. And so I'm just praying and hoping against hope. Ashabanta, he calls it. Just hoping against hope that somehow or other you will be kind to me. That's all we can do. But if we meet a devotee, then the devotee is instantly going to affect that. So this devotee asks Srila Prabhupada that, you know, we don't have anything. So, you know, Krishna says that those who are fixed in piety, they can persevere with a mature commitment to pure devotional service. Anybody know that verse? Chapter 7, text number, if there were brahmacharis here, they would know. 28. Yesham tvantagatam papam jananam punyakarmanam te dvandva moha nirmukta bhajante mam dridhavrataha. Krishna describes them in two ways. He says they're dridhavrataha. They're firm in their vows, in their resolve. And what else does he say about them? They're dvandva moha nirmukta. That means to say they're freed from all the illusions, all the misconceptions that accrue from indulging in duality in this material world. They're free of all that. Therefore, there's no obstruction. They can proceed straight on the path of bhakti without impediments. That's sometimes called nishtha bhakti. So a person should be fortunate in order to really respond to the mercy of a bona fide spiritual master, because that mercy will fall on the rocks. It will fall in the ocean as well as on the fertile ground. So we should try to make ourselves fertile ground for receiving the mercy of such a spiritual master. That's why Varnashram is important. That's why Srila Prabhupada gave roughly 80% of his instructions on the topic of Varnashram in the last 3 years that he was with us, and he was pushing it with increased urgency, because he saw that his own disciples were having problems, as they still are, because ISKCON hasn't really produced much in that department in the last 40 or so years since Prabhupada gave the instructions. But anyway, if somehow or other we can respond to the mercy of a pure devotee, then we advance in these ways. So first is causeless mercy, then we serve the devotees and get some faith. Because when we associate and serve devotees, that's when faith is generated. If we don't have sufficient faith, that means you've not sufficiently associated properly with more advanced devotees. Then we can, there's any question of Gurupada Ashraya, taking shelter of a bona fide spiritual master. It is not the first step. This is the point. It is not the first step. There are preliminaries. So, then I'll go on to the next verse. This is First Canto, Chapter 5, Text 25. Uchishta lepan anamodito dvijayahi sakritsma bhunje tat apasta kilbishaha evam pravrittasya vishuddha chetasas tat dhanama evatma ruchihi prajayate. This is very nice. He says, once only, by their permission, I took the remnants of their food, and by doing so, all my sins were at once eradicated. Thus being engaged, I became purified in heart, and at that time the very nature of the transcendentalist became attractive to me. Sridhar Swami says, "Permitted by those twice-born men, I ate the remnants stuck to their plates. By that act I was freed of sins, and my mind's taste for exclusive worship of the Supreme Lord, as per their nature," he was witnessing this, "that it, the attachment for that arose as a consequence." Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, "He, having developed an inclination for bhakti and being pure in mind, the taste for devotional service inevitably developed further." So, and he tells us that it was rice, just in case you're wondering. Pieces of rice stuck to their dishes. By that, all obstacles to bhakti were destroyed. Tadapasta kilabishaha. Without effort, I developed bhakti in the form of hearing and chanting and remembering the Lord continually. Having developed a tendency for bhakti, after eating the devotees' food, the uchishta means the remnants left by the devotees, evam pravrittasya, which applies to anyone else as well, I inevitably developed taste, ruchi, prajayate, for hearing and chanting. In my mind, their very nature became attractive to me. Tad dharma. Dharma means the nature of something. It's a very rich word, hard to translate. So, by this verse, five stages of bhakti should be understood. That is to say, there's a desire to worship, there's devotional service itself, there's anartanivritti, nishtha, and ruchi, which means we have an initial desire, we actually do something for Krishna selflessly, as we were fortunate enough to hear from Shachinandan Maharaj the other night. When we do that, the obstacles that remain within our hearts become purified. And when we become fixed in that practice, then we get a real taste for devotion. We have some shadow taste now, and we're engaged in some shadow devotion as well. But if we want it to become real, these are the keys. These are the keys. So these five stages, like the four stages mentioned in the previous verse, they're listed originally in his commentary on the second chapter of this canto, text 21. Another famous verse, and I'll end here. Bhidyate hridaya granthish chidyante sarva samshayaha kshiyante chasya kramani drishta evatmanishvare. Thus the knot in the heart is pierced, all misgivings are cut to pieces, the chain of fruitive actions is terminated when one sees the self as master. That is to say, the self is the master of the senses, mind and body. Now he goes on to say that when Narad Muni saw the Lord in this way, after having become perfect through his practice of what the Bhaktivedantas taught him, even in their absence, he eventually saw the Lord. First he saw the Lord within his mind, and then he actually opened his eyes and saw the Lord directly, Sakshatkar. So thus, both the manifestation of the Lord in the mind and the direct appearance to the eyes are indicated here. Now, he gives a very interesting verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is his own verse here that he adds. He says, Satam kripa mahat seva shraddha guru padashrayaha bhajaneshu spriha bhaktir anardha bhagamastataha nishtha ruchir athashakti rati prematha darshanam Harir Madhuryanubhava Ityartha Syush Chiturdashe. He outlines the process of spiritual advancement and devotional service in 14 steps, which are a little bit different than what we might have heard from Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But very interesting. So these things should occur, he says. First, mercy of devotees. We've read some of these already in the previous verse. Then, service to the devotees. Then faith, then surrender to the Guru, then desire for worship, then actual devotional service itself, then the anarthas are cleared away, we become fixed, we gain a taste, we become addicted, and then we get real rati or bhava, some emotions for the Lord are awakened, and then finally prem, seeing the Lord and experiencing the Lord's sweetness. These are some interesting things to think about with regards to the power of association with devotees. These things are all affected simply by associating with those devotees who are pure in heart, who are, especially if they're more advanced than us. All these things are affected. Just we have to be very patient and enthusiastic, and we have to follow the process very carefully. Srila Prabhupada instructed us, Sri Guru Charana Padma Kevala Bhakti Sattva Bandomui Savadhanamate, means the only place you're going to find devotion residing in is the house that we call the lotus feet of the spiritual master. And therefore we should bow down very carefully. This verse will tell us how to do that. Anyone have any questions or comments on any of these things? Yeah, please.
So first of all, like what you read about the 14 steps by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, can you tell me like which canto, which chapter was it?
You will find it in this verse. Is the only place I've ever seen it. I just happened to come across it when I was reading this.
So it's not in any Bhagavad?
Well, Rupa Goswami wrote a very similar verse.
Yeah,
he said, Adho Shraddha Tata Sadhu Sangatha Vajana Kriya Adhyadi. It's just that he prefaces it with this very essential and sometimes I think overlooked item, which is that first thing is causeless mercy. There's two or three steps before we can even take shelter of the spiritual master, and he's the one who's supposed to train us.
So in this regard, like, I have another question. That first you said that the first step is the causeless mercy. So isn't it before that we have to be a suitable patra? That means we have to be a suitable candidate to accept that mercy. That comes from good fortune. So where the fortune plays a role.
Yeah. In a sense, you can say that. The fact of the matter is that, like he said, Shukadeva Goswami said, you know, the mountains, they sometimes release water and they sometimes don't release water. Sometimes they're kind to people and sometimes they're not. They're neutral. But the saints generally also, because they see everyone equally, they don't discriminate on the basis of some qualities that the patra shows. Patra meaning the recipient. They don't discriminate that this person deserves mercy. That's not mercy. Causeless mercy means it may be a rock in which no seed can sprout, or it may be fertile land in which anything can grow. But they just let the water go. That's the way they are. So we have the responsibility to make ourselves as receptive as we can. Because it's also true that although the saints don't always necessarily dispense transcendental wisdom to us, and although it's also true that not everyone is a good recipient, if we cultivate piety within our hearts, then when and if we get causeless mercy, then we will be able to. This is the importance of the Varnashram system that we mentioned. Now, I'm going to just divert a little bit because it's a very important reference that I'm thinking of. There's a verse that Srila Prabhupada quotes ubiquitously throughout his books. Varnashram acharavata purushena parapuman. You know this verse? Vishnur aradhyate pungsam nanyat tattosha karanam. This is a very famous verse that says there's actually no way to please Lord Vishnu except to perform your duties within the Varnashram system. And it's very often quoted. The context of that verse is very interesting. In the Vishnu Purana, I think it's in the sixth book, Sagarda Maharaj, a great pious king, has approached his spiritual master Arava Muni. And he had a very important question for his spiritual master, a question that's relevant to every single member of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Oops. He asked his spiritual master, considering that he was the king, he was thinking he had a sense of responsibility. I have to somehow or other make these people Krishna conscious. What am I going to do about it? This is something that's on the minds of all the devotees as well. So he asked his spiritual master directly, what can I do to actually bring ordinary people to pure devotional service? He wasn't asking about anything other than pure devotional service. And his spiritual master gave him a very long answer that it spans several chapters in which this verse appears. This verse is perhaps representative of the mood of the whole chapter. And we've just been explaining the reason that this varnashram is actually so essential, because it prepares one. It fertilizes, if you will, the soil of the heart, so that if the seed of bhakti is planted by some merciful Vaishnava, then it can sprout easily. Otherwise, you know, sometimes you see, you know, little blades of grass or small trees are growing within the cracks of a sidewalk. It's possible. But, you know, it's not that common. You see? So that's also embedded within Krishna's instructions that we quoted already from chapter 7. You know, the importance of being pious. If you're pious and freed from sinful reaction, then when you're given this bhakti process, you can accommodate it. And you can perform it. You can sustain. Shall I go further? This year's ILS meetings in Mayapur, if anyone was fortunate enough to hear from Devamrita Swami there, he gave a very interesting seminar on, he titled it, Challenges and Crises, or Challenges and Obstacles in 21st Century Urban Preaching. Again, this is a central concern to all ISKCON devotees, especially in the Western world, which, in case you haven't noticed, it's... you know, could use a shot in the arm of some sort. So he said there are, he feels that there are three reasons that we have trouble. We're not doing as well, maybe we can say, as we were when Prabhupada was here or in the years just after his departure. He said the first thing is that we don't make it easy for people to either adopt Krishna consciousness or to sustain Krishna consciousness. And they look like two different things, but they're actually the same thing. And what's lacking in either case is this dharma that we're talking about. If you are not pious to begin with, then when you receive the book, or when you're given some prasadam, you may not be able to respond that much. And even if you sincerely desire to adopt Krishna consciousness, and you may even join ISKCON and take initiation and serve for many years. I've seen it. But if there is lingering anarthas from so many years of impiety, then it's hard to advance. Or you go away after some time. You see? And, you know, in between, if we can engage a person also according to that person's own potential, comfortably, if the person is properly situated, then it makes it a little easier. You know, the process of declaring war on your own heart, as it were, which is what we have to do, you know, it makes it easier if there's less chaos in your external life, or even in your internal life, because, you know, what's the number one thing any doctor knows in America, especially? It's over sense gratification makes you go nuts. And if you haven't noticed it, just step outside of America for a few years and come back. It will slap you in the face. It's quite salient for anyone who doesn't live here. So, this is what he's talking about. It's really just a question of dharma. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada thought, he moves on to his second point. He never mentioned dharma as far as I know, but it's implicit. Here. His second point was that we have not very well applied or even understood, I think, Srila Prabhupada's formula for having an urban preaching center supported by a self-sustainable agrarian community, which is also a good example of the ideals of the Srimad Bhagavatam, socio-economic ideals. Srila Prabhupada had that very clear in mind, and he was very strongly pushing it, as I said, especially in his later years. And, you know, in many cases it seems to me that our attempts to fulfill those instructions have not been very fruitful, mainly because the concept is not clearly formulated yet. You have to appreciate that among Western devotees in particular, Western people in general, they do not have a sense of dharma. That's the only reason that the word dharma or some perfect synonym for it doesn't exist in the English language. Therefore, I said it's a hard word to translate. Sometimes we translate it as dutti, and that's correct. Sometimes we translate it as the essential property of a thing. That's also correct. Sometimes we translate it as, I mean, there are so many things, and they're all of them at the same time. All the above. And there's no one word in English that subsumes all that, the entire arena of meaning that should be attached to that word. The reason there's no such word is because the concept has not been there yet. It has to be introduced. It's kind of like when you go to China and try to preach there. People have a very hazy idea of what God is because it's just an entirely new concept to them. It's very difficult. You see? In this way, because the concept has not been clearly... concept of dharma generally, what to speak of varnashram dharma in particular, because there are also many different kinds of dharmas, you see? So it's not surprising that, you know, I mean, and then you add to that the fact that the people who are going and buying the land to start the farm project, they don't know the difference between rocky soil and fertile land, and, you know, it just, nothing works. There's a very nice verse in the 11th canto, Krishna instructs Uddhava. I don't know what time it is, but I'll try to end soon. He says that sve sve adhikare yanishta saguna parikirtataha. That means that when a person is properly situated in that for which he has prerogative, the best word that I've found to translate adhikar is prerogative, because prerogative means you have the right to do it, but you also have the duty to do it. And you have the ability to do it, all at the same time, all those three. So, you know, adhikar, that's what adhikar means. You have the right to do it, you have the ability to do it, and you have the onus of doing it. You see? So when a person does what that person is perfectly suited to do, and does not attempt anything more than that, that we know is the Peter principle, right? And does not settle for anything less than that, then that is called guna. And to do anything else is called dosa. Guna means a qualification, and dosa means a flaw. You see? This has to be understood. This is not pure Krishna consciousness, but pure Krishna consciousness is predicated upon this. Because you can hardly take shelter of this lotus feet of the spiritual master without understanding these things. So it's all part of dharma, and it's a very, very important topic. So you're right, by becoming pious in these ways and by deepening our understanding of dharma, particularly among the non-Indian devotees, but increasingly even among the Indian devotees, because, you know, I mean, just go and check out Noida and you'll know very much what I'm talking about. You can't find a single cow in Noida. Can't find one. So, you know, and they come and ask questions, so whose father is Sita? So, yeah, this is an important thing. Is that okay?
Yes.
Anything else? Other questions? Or any other answers? Yeah, please.
So, Prabhupada, so we are talking of like the initial mercy that comes.
The causeless mercy.
Yeah,
the
causeless mercy. But like having received the mercy, what are the qualifications to be fertile to actually invest and reap?
Yeah, well, that we've been discussing for the last hour or so. I mean, here Narad Muni has said that, you know, some of his, he says he had sense control. He was not attached to frivolous things. He didn't get agitated. He was obedient. He was attentive. And he didn't talk too much. People in the modern realm, it seems, especially on the internet, you know, it seems they're more attached to talking than to hearing. The one verse we mentioned last night, which verse did Prabhupada speak on more than any other from Bhagavad Gita? Yatajnyasasi tachrinu. Just basically shut up and listen. I mean, that's a little crude, but... if you're interested, he says, if you want to know, then just listen. It takes time. And it takes more than time. It takes these other things as well. So these are some things. Another good formula, I maybe don't, haven't assimilated fully, but at least appreciate in theory. Chapter 12 of the Bhagavad Gita, in the last, say, half dozen verses or so, Krishna tells us openly what are the qualities that endear his devotee to him. So we work on those qualities. Now, the beauty of this process is it is so absolutely potent that varnashram or no varnashram, dharma or adhikar or, you know, or not, it is punya shravana kirtana. It makes you pious and faster than anything else can. So someone might question, well, then what is the need? Why did Prabhupada push so much on these other things? That's a hard question. Everybody follow the question? It's kind of like deity worship. In this day and age, we are to only chant the holy name, and yet we're still doing deity worship. The explanation that I've heard is that the deity worship will pacify and still your mind to the degree that you can actually accommodate the holy name within that mind. Otherwise, we're so scrambled and agitated all the time. You know? It's toast. Otherwise. So. Is that okay? Anything else?
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, please.
I was just actually, kind of more of a thought than a question, but I was actually thinking, when you're reading the qualifications for somebody who is, you know, quote unquote, fertile or to receive the mercy, I was actually just thinking, like, Prabhupada's mercy must have been, like, so potent, because when you're describing the qualities of that person, it seems like it's the exact opposite of the hippie movement. I mean, essentially, the hippie movement was a revolt almost against Dharma in some sense.
That's right. And I didn't actually finish the story, but when this devotee came and asked Srila Prabhupada, you know, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that a person has to be pious, so what about us? What about our good fortune? Well, where's that? You know what Prabhupada said? This is a famous one, so you probably do. He said, I created your good fortune. That is what we're talking about in this verse. That's called causeless mercy. So basically, we're unpacking and dilating on this principle of causeless mercy here. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary, makes it very clear that we should not consider otherwise. It's a very important thing. Because otherwise that means that not only the devotees, but even Krishna himself, he plays favorites. He becomes conditional. So, this is the idea. He says very clearly that we should consider it like this. Causeless means causeless. Anything else? Yeah, please.
One time I was in a Java retreat with Satyanand Maharaj, and at the end of it, he was talking about taking association and sadhu sangha, and he said one also very important point is that we need to search out those devotees that have some affection for us, and then we are able to progress and to render service and to be able to hear nicely. So if you wanted to elaborate on that.
We should actively seek out association with devotees who actually are naturally merciful to us. I think the assumption here is also that those devotees are more advanced. Otherwise, you know, we go to find the people who flatter us, and that doesn't help anyone. So, the important qualification in association is always that the person has to be more advanced. Now, what does more advanced actually mean, practically? What does it mean to be more advanced?
To develop the love of God.
Love of God, more, anything else?
Pure.
Pure, more pure, more love in love with Krishna. Anything else? I'm looking for a Shastric answer here. You can tie it to a specific Shastric reference. Okay, I mean that's Shastric, but what I'm thinking of is the thing that actually distinguishes our different levels of advancement and our different levels of adhikar. Kanishta Adhikar or Madhyam Adhikar or Uttam Adhikar in devotional service is only one very simple thing, which is the development or the deepening of our
faith.
Yeah. So we want to seek out devotees whose faith is more deep than ours. Then by associating with those persons, I mean, Prabhupada has commented in this passage of the Bhagavatam that devotional service is like an infectious disease in the positive sense. It is so powerful if we have the association with someone whose faith is much, much stronger than ours, because that faith is going to naturally manifest itself in action. And when we see that action and understand what has inspired the action, then it's a very, very powerful thing. It's a very powerful thing. I can say many things about this. This is the idea. We want to associate with those whose faith is much deeper than ours, and we will be influenced by that. It's so powerful that practically it's involuntary. You put yourself in the right association, you're going to catch that disease. Mm.
Can you give a specific example of people who
this is Narad Muni. He's a little boy. He just happens to be there. His mother engages him in serving the Bhaktivedantas. You know? I mean, did they know what would happen by their association? Who had read the script? You see? There are so many. I mean, actually, you know, you have to say that it's every example of anyone who's ever become Krishna conscious is an example of this principle, because this is how you become Krishna conscious. I mentioned last night also that someone said that Prabhupada said that advancement is 90%, what is it? Association is 90% of our advancement. Mm-hmm. So that's true even in the material world. Not to speak of in the spiritual world. But we've all experienced, I mean, we have joined ISKCON, or we're attracted to ISKCON at least, or we've taken initiation even within ISKCON, only because we've come in contact with a person whose strong faith has made a deep impression on us. Every single one of us is a walking example of this principle, because this is simply how it works. It's a near absolute phenomenon. The only exception that I'm aware of is what we call kripasiddha, in which Krishna just makes you perfect out of his own whim, with no reason whatsoever, causelessly again. Cause us mercy. I mean, there are so many stories, but I can't think of a really good one offhand. I mean, so many. They're just, you know, Bilva Mangala Thakur and the prostitute. What was he going to see her for? And one day she let him have it, because she was actually a good-hearted person. Despite her karma, she was a devotee, and she said, "Are, if you would be this much attached to Krishna, there's no telling where you would go back to Godhead instantly." That moved him in a very powerful way, and it changed his life. Very interesting story, that one. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Maybe someone you can explain. I don't think so everybody knows about.
Okay, in South India, near probably around Satara in Maharashtra, near the banks of the Krishna Bhima River, there was a Brahmin who was quite learned and very good in music. His name was Bilva Mangala. He was an expert poet, Sanskrit poet. Somehow or other, by his bad karma, you know, the hrichaya, the things lying in his heart, were somehow agitated, and he became attracted to one, we want to say Vaishya, prostitute. But we have to understand that in those days, in that cultural context, the prostitute was actually more like a geisha, a very cultured lady. And she was a very expert musician as well, so this attracted his ears as well. So he developed some relationship with her, he became attached, and he used to go to see her all the time. So much so that, you know, even though he had a perfect wife and pious parents at home. Everything was good in his life, but this is the way it works sometimes in the material world. So he became attached in this way. He couldn't give up that illicit relationship. And even, he would go every day, and even it's said that when his father died, he was very agitated to finish up the funeral so that he could go and visit her again that very night. No period of mourning or anything for him. And not only that, but the night was storming and raining tremendously. That was no impediment for him. He went through the storm, and then he's found a raging river, and no boatman in his right mind is going to try to negotiate that. So what did he do? He swam across the river, or tried, and nearly drowned in the process. But there was some big log floating on the river. He just somehow grabbed a hold of that and, you know, saved his life, somehow made it to the some shore. When he got to the shore, he found out that that log was actually a corpse. Stiff. You know, because in the rainy season everything is agitated, right? And sometimes people are too poor for a cremation, they just chuck them in this nearest holy river. So I actually had that experience once in Mayapur. Came across such a thing. But that's another story. Anyway, so he then found this woman's house. No surprise, the gate is locked and bolted on a stormy, thundering night. So what to do? He's banging and screaming, but nobody can hear him because it's so loud storm going on. And who would suspect that he would come on such a night anyway? So what did he do? He tried to climb the slippery wall. Hope springs eternal. This is as good as Jarasandha, right? 17 times smashed by Krishna. He's still ready to go. So this is called Maya. This is how Maya works. Anyway, so he's climbing up the wall, and he's, you know, it's very slippery, so he grabs onto some vine as happened to be there, and he pulls himself over the top, but the vine was actually not a vine, it was a serpent, like a cobra or something. Could have been killed. He throws himself over the wall, and he lands in the nala on the other side. You know, those black water that you see in the gutters of Vrindavan. He landed there, you know, bruised up, cut, filthy, half conscious, exhausted, you know, but still determined. Then, you know, her maidservants heard some commotion out there, so a few of them came with some lantern and found out that, oh, hey, it's Bilva Mangala, what's he doing here? She called him inside, and she took care of him and got him into some decent shape. And said, "Oh, I can't believe you've come here like this. And if you had this determination just to serve Krishna the way that you're attracted to me, then you would be back to Godhead already." She said, "I don't know about you, but from this day on, I'm completely ashamed of my profession because I'm cheating all these men, telling them that I actually love them when I don't care a fig about them, including you. So beginning from tomorrow, I'm just going to do Bhagavad Bhajan." And she got together with her friends. She was already a musician, as we said. And they did Utkirtan, Hari Kirtan. Very nice Kirtan they did. I mean, actually, I think, as I recall, this is described in Kaviraj Goswami's commentary of the Krishna Karnamrita first verse, the life story of Bilva Mangala. It's the only really authoritative version. There's lots of different versions, but... Anyway, so she got, I think she may have stayed up all night, that night, with her friends chanting Sankirtana. And so did he. He sat and listened, and in the morning he paid obeisances and said, "You have become my Shiksha Guru." Yeah, not Shiksha Guru, but technically we call Vartama Pradarshak, the one who shows the path. You've done this for me. It's a big change for my life. And he paid his obeisances and he took her leave, and then he went to find a Diksha Guru and he took initiation. And then he was doing bhajan for some time, and gradually his heart became agitated with a desire to go to Vrindavan. He was composing poetry. He was already a poet, and his guru gave him the name Lilashuk, Lilashuk. He's like, you know, as far as describing the Leelas of Krishna, he's like Shukdev Goswami. Then he went to Vrindavan, and, you know, this is another encouraging thing, that our samskars are very strong. And even though his intelligence was convinced, and even though he'd made a decision, even though he had taken initiation, but somehow or other he became attracted by another man's wife on the way. And senseless of the holy cloth that he was wearing, saffron cloth, he followed her home and is asking for bhikshu there. And the wife, you know, because the women are very sensitive in these ways, she told her husband, you know, he's, you know. And so the husband said, okay, what you should do is serve him. Do whatever he wants. He's a sadhu. We have our dharma. Even if he's not doing his dharma, we have to do our dharma. So she cooked a nice meal for him, and she presented herself to him afterwards and said, I'm at your service. And he said, he was so completely ashamed by the character of these householders. And the husband also, who gave his wife not only permission, but the order. So he said, yes, Mata, please give me your hairpins. And she thought, why was he? Who knows? I mean, he's a weird guy anyway. So she gave him her hairpins, and he took these hairpins and he said, these eyes have caused me so much problem. He said, I'd better I do without them. He put them into his eyes, put out his own eyes on the spot. Just see, something of his character also. You should not be very quick to judge people. You never really know what's inside, what they're capable of. So for the purpose of his Krishna consciousness, when he was finally awakened again from, you know, what is that, habits die hard, they say. This is what he did. So blind now, he continued on to Vrindavan. So how would he get to Vrindavan? How do you go to Vrindavan when you're blind? Walking. Therefore, he had some help. Someone came and was taking him by the hand and telling him where to go. After some time, he figured out that this is not an ordinary person. This is the person that I'm worshipping. And he tried to trick Krishna in so many ways by grabbing him. But every time, Bilvamangala isn't, by this time he's an old man and he's blind, so, you know, he's a little quick little kid, what can you do? Krishna got away every time. So then he composed a famous verse. He says, Hastam akshipya yatosi balat Krishna kim adbhutam hridayad yadi niryasi paurusham ganayamite. He says, dear Krishna, you've escaped from my arms. That's not a surprise. After all, I'm old man, I'm blind, Daddy. He said, but if you can get out of my heart, then I will consider you to be a strong man. So Krishna took him all the way to Vrindavan, and in Vrindavan he settled near Brahmakund, Gopinath Bazar, we call it. His Samadhi Mandir is still there. He finished writing his books there, Krishna Karnamrita and other things, many books he wrote. Beautiful Sanskrit verses in glorification of Krishna and his pastimes. And he lived for a long, long life there, worshipping Krishna in the end. And he says, Chintamani Jayati Soma Girir Gurur Me Shiksha Gurushta Bhagavan Shikipi Chimaldihi. That means that I'm offering my obeisances first to my Vartma Pradarsha Guru. The prostitute's name was Chintamani. Chintamani. And my Diksha Guru, his name was Somagiri. So he's my Diksha Guru. And Bhagavan Shikipit Shimali, that is my Shiksha Guru. He showed me the way to Vrindavan. He's been guiding me ever since. He tells me what to say. He's my Shiksha Guru, Dilha Mangal Thakur. So this is a good example. Even sometimes a lotus flower grows out of filthy water, muddy water. It's liyasko pankaj कहते हैं ना तो पंकज इट्स बोर्न इन द मड बट इट पुशेस थ्रू द वाटर वॉश्ड ऑफ इट कम्स आउट ऑफ द वाटर एंड देन इट ब्लूम्स कंप्लीटली प्रिस्टीन लोटस फ्लावर डिवोटीज आर लाइक दैट They're in the world, but not of the world. But we have to be purified in this way, and it happens through association with devotees, even if that association looks like a prostitute. You see? Women can be gurus also. Even a prostitute can be a guru. And we have to appreciate not only his humility, that big Brahmin, learned scholar, nobody knew he was going to the prostitute, but he was humble enough that when she spoke the truth, he accepted it. And he was determined enough that even when his anartas caught up with him after some time, he was still determined. He did the needful. That's not to be tried at home, kids. But the idea is there. Okay, we're going on a long time. I think we should stop here. No, one more question.
This story about Bilamangla Thakur, a question was raised, how was it possible for him to have such determination to blind himself? And the answer was that he had already attained the state of power in his previous life. So, having attained the state of Bhava, even after the state of Bhava, one can still fall down to sense gratification. Bilamangla Thakur is one example, and Jada Bharat is another example. So, and earlier you were talking, you mentioned about discipline, dharma, and all that. And we have, you know, many examples we have seen in our ISKCON movement. Devotees who joined this movement for many years and are not able to maintain the discipline on a consistent basis. Some, even after many years, they still fall down. They still, you know, they still have problems with the senses. Are you following my question?
Yep.
And still here, in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna has mentioned, there's a verse where Krishna says that by experiencing a higher taste, one naturally loses the lower taste. Right? So from this we can understand that it is very, very important to be able to have this higher taste. And this higher taste can only come by the Lord's mercy, to be somehow connected with this internal potency. That's where the taste comes from. So, based on that, how important is it in our spiritual life to listen to those Bhaktivedantas, those powerful advanced Vaishnavas, who can speak about Krishna in such a way that can connect us with the internal potency of the Lord and impart this higher taste to us?
Well, that's been the topic of the whole class. Very, very important. It's an essential item. And particularly the spiritual master is the most, you know, central of all the sadhus that we may be receiving mercy or inspiration from. That's the subject matter of the whole class. It's very powerful. It's essential to, I mean, we discussed this last night also. There are two ways to associate with a spiritual master in particular. One is Vapu and the other one is Vani. Mm. The significance of the spiritual master's physical personality is the Vani that he speaks. But without the personal presence of the spiritual master also, it's not that easy to access the Vani. To give an example, I gave this example last night, that a devotee who is personally trained by Srila Prabhupada in how to apply the principles of bhakti is going to have, you know, it's saved so much time and difficulty.
But this principle of spiritual master is not confined to just one particular person. The spiritual master is Guru Tattva, and this Guru Tattva can appear anywhere.
Can, yes. Srila Prabhupada says in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adilila chapter 1, in several purports there he discusses the principle of the spiritual master. And he says generally the spiritual master is one. I think it's been my experience in ISKCON for the last 40 years, and particularly since Srila Prabhupada left, that there's an increased emphasis on a distinction between one's Diksha Guru and Shiksha Guru that basically did not exist before 1977. That's maybe not a bad thing, or I'm not making any judgment on it, but it was not there before. That's my experience. Prabhupada says that the general standard is that the Diksha Guru and the Shiksha Guru are one and the same personality. If that's not possible, then certainly we have, you know, any number of Shiksha Gurus are possible, and one can derive inspiration from them and enlightenment from them. But it's good to keep in mind that this is not like it's been an eternal tradition. I think is what I want to say. I think it engenders a healthy sense of what Prabhupada perhaps meant by his instruction in that report. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, I think we have to stop now. Yeah. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much.